We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who share how meditation and mindfulness practices change our lives. Our podcast is brought to you by Meditation Studio, Apple's pick as one of the 10 best apps of the year. Why download the app? Because life is messy. We get stressed, anxious, have trouble sleeping, we work too hard, we deal with conflict, our hearts get broken. We worry about the state of the world. We meditate because we're human. Our app gives you hundreds of meditations from over 30 leading experts. It helps a lot. And if you haven't tried the app yet, you can now download it for free and explore a starter series with Elisha Goldstein, plus a sample of some of our favorite guided meditations in the Discover collection. And if you've already got the app, check out our new unguided meditation timer, where you can create your own meditations with or without our brand new, pretty amazing music tracks. And don't forget the 8 free meditations on Alexa. Just ask her to enable Meditation Studio. Today's guest is Dr. Rick Hansen, a psychologist and author of several books, including his most recent New York Times bestseller, Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. His work and research is at the intersection of neuroscience, psychology, and Buddhism. In this interview, he shares practices that help us cultivate and experience the good in our lives while growing compassion for ourselves and others. This, he says, can actually help reduce negative thinking and hardwire our brains for greater happiness. Dr. Hansen shares how these simple methods using the power of everyday experiences can really help to counter our natural negativity biases. Now, here's Dr. Rick Hansen. Rick Hansen, welcome to Untangle. I'm so happy to have you on our show today.
Patricia, really, it's a pleasure.
Aw. So I loved your book. And I want to know what inspired you to begin researching how to hardwire happiness. I guess this would kind of be your origin story.
Right. Once upon a time, I was a little boy. And like a lot of little kids, I knew things I couldn't put into words. And one thing I knew is that there was a lot of unnecessary unhappiness around me. My neighborhood, my school, I could see the grownups. nothing horrible, but a lot of unnecessary tension, bickering, hassle, and suffering, including inside my own family. And in my heart, my earliest memories is of truly a deep, poignant, wistful longing to understand why and what to do about it. And that kind of set me on my way. And then I landed in college at the tail end of the 60s, early 70s, kind of at the height of the human potential movement in California. I caught that wave. That took me into meditation in 1974 and a knowledge of sort of Eastern traditions, including the one I'm most trained in, which is Buddhism. And then as I became a psychologist, got a PhD, right at starting around 20 or so years ago, I started my clinical training about 30 or so years ago, but 20 years ago or so, neuroscience began to explode. So we have this coming together of psychology, contemplative wisdom, and brain science, but it really does get to the heart of what interests me, which is how to use the penetrating insights of the great spiritual traditions, turbocharged by modern psychology and brain science, to offer skillful means to people in the trenches of real life to change the causes of suffering and to grow the causes of happiness, love, and wisdom.
Ooh, I love the way you put that. I just want to wind back a little bit because it sounded like you were an incredibly sensitive child, the way that you were describing your observations of seeing all of this unnecessary unhappiness and tension. Yeah. Were you a sensitive child in how you observed the world?
I think I was perceptive. And my temperament is really pretty calm and even keel. I would say, actually, it's very interesting for people in general to reflect back on the things they knew in their bones, intuitively in their body when they were young. And I think a lot of people would say that when they were young, and even now as adults, that there is this recognition that there's just a lot of unnecessary stress, tension, hassle, conflict, and unhappiness.
Yeah. It's amazing that that is what set you off on your path in life. And that's what I think is so beautiful about this. And I do like the way you talk about, you know, the beginning of neuroscience and psychology and Buddhism and how they all intersect. And so you studied those different areas and then you turned that into how do we create more happiness in our lives?
Yeah.
So when you talk about, like in the intro of your book, you say, I'll show you how to turn good moments into a great brain full of confidence, ease, comfort, self-worth. Will you talk a little bit about that, you know, kind of how that works?
Right. So to kind of create a context here is a bit of a framework, especially when we are approaching this in something of a meditative way. I think that there basically are three ways to practice with the mind. The first of the three great ways is the foundation, which is simply to be with what's there. Feel the feelings, experience the experience, hopefully with a quality of acceptance and curiosity and self-compassion, hopefully with a sense of untangling the threads of experience, deconstructing experience, sensing down to what's younger, more vulnerable, more fundamental. In the process of being with your own mind, it often changes, but you're not trying to change it directly. Okay, that's very important. But it's not the only way to practice. The second great way to practice is to prevent or decrease or abandon entirely what's unwholesome, problematic, unwise, painful, harmful, and so forth. Like releasing tension from the body, venting feelings, releasing thoughts that are not helpful, abandoning unwholesome desires, etc. And then the third great way to practice is to cultivate the good. It's to grow compassion, mindfulness, gratitude, grit, resilience, self-worth, confidence, happiness, to grow the good. All three are important. My book, Hardwiring Happiness, in particular, focuses on the third of those, the cultivation aspects of practice in Sanskrit, bhavana, but it's in the larger context. So that said, and I speak as a psychologist and also a guy who's lived in the real world. I have a business background. I've been married a long time, raised now two adult kids. And if we're going to deal with the long road of life, we need to have resources inside ourselves. That's what we draw on to deal with ordinary challenges. It's what we draw on to pursue our opportunities and resources also or what we draw upon to get through real adversity, including trauma. And also we draw on resources to cultivate awakening, So what are those awakening factors? What are those inner resources? And there are things like positive emotion, secure attachment, self-worth, commitment to social justice, empathy, muscles, in a sense, inner strengths of various kinds. So then the question becomes, and I'm a very practical guy, how do you grow those inner strengths? How do you actually acquire more resources over time? And then that takes us right into the neuropsychology of learning. And the way we acquire inner resources like gratitude or compassion or wisdom is in two steps, necessarily in two steps. First step is to experience what you want to grow. And the second necessary step is to turn that experience into a lasting change in the body, principally in the nervous system and the brain. And so lots and lots of people are good at the first step. They're good at having beneficial experiences, but they don't pay much attention to actually turning that experience into a lasting change in their brain. And that's what I've really super focused on in Hardwiring Happiness and more generally. I'm sure we'll talk about how to do that, but the essence is simple. Stay with the experience for a breath or two or three. A second, really feel it in your body, whatever you're trying to grow. And third, be aware, be mindful of what's rewarding or meaningful in the experience. Those three fundamental factors, duration, the longer we experience it, increases the encoding and consolidating of an experience in the nervous system. Second, whole-bodied experiencing, the richer the experience, the more it's in your emotions, the more it's in your sensations, the more memory traces it's going to leave behind. And third, the more you tune into what's rewarding or meaningful about it, that gets neurotransmitters like dopamine and norepinephrine going, which really turn that experience into a keeper. So its residues really sink into you. And then increasingly, you take those inner strengths with you wherever you go.
Yeah. And just stepping back to the three ways to practice, because I think all this makes a lot of sense. And I want to also understand, is how similar is this to positive psychology and how different it is. Mm-hmm. But I'm also curious, I mean, it almost sounds like you would have to figure out a way to balance out decreasing what's unwholesome or what's causing you pain or stress or suffering before you move into cultivating the experiential part of what you're talking about.
You're exactly right. And to be crystal clear, and it's why I set up that framework of ways to practice, first and foremost, we need to feel what's there. And nothing in what I'm saying is about turning away from what's painful or turning a blind eye to it or doing a spiritual bypass, fake it till you make it, rose-colored glasses, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing in what I'm saying is about that. But what I am saying is that, frankly, I think that that stand of, in some ways, inert witnessing, passive witnessing, mindfulness alone has become overvalued. And it's a mistaken understanding of the spiritual traditions, and it's certainly a mistaken understanding of the body. At the end of the day, we are not just mindful of the body, we are bodyful of mind. It is the body that is producing the mind, certainly inside the natural frame, without referring yet to anything supernatural or transcendental. So if we want to help things get better, we actually need to face the implications of embodiment. What does it actually take to heal the body, to awaken the body, to enlighten the body? And that's a process that's physical at bottom. And that physical process must involve changing the brain so that our tendencies toward anxiety or irritation or resentment or aggression or ignorance, those tendencies, those habits are changed in the brain. And also in the body, we actually need to change the brain to become more compassionate, to become more grateful, to become happier, to become more resilient over time. And the brain doesn't just change on its own. Merely witnessing a stream of consciousness does not itself release the crud floating down that stream, nor does merely witnessing the stream of consciousness increase good stuff to flow down that stream.
So you talk.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are five new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. but they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Talk about like being with what's there. That's the mindfulness practice. That's that alone is not enough. And then it with the second step of decreasing or preventing what makes you feel bad, that negative, the negative side of things. What is the practice for that? And then I know, like, I feel like I understand what you're saying about cultivating the good in terms of really opening up and enriching that experience. Yeah. But I don't know if I fully understand what happens in that second way to practice.
So a couple points here. So first, mindfulness should be present in all three forms of practice.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as we, to bring it down to earth, let's say, you know, I've been married a while. Let's say something happens and I notice that I'm getting irritated about something or frustrated by something. So first, it's important to witness that, to be aware of it, to be with it, to explore it, to feel it fully. Second, often, fairly quickly, it's a familiar emotional reaction. It reminds me of my mother, who knows, you know, stuff stirred up from the past. And then it's time to move into what the Buddha referred to in the Eightfold Path as wise effort, which is basically half of wise effort is the second form of practice that I've described. What's negative, what's problematic, and the other aspect of wise effort is growing the positive. So let's say I'm irritated or frustrated with my wife or something, you know, I'm a little triggered from my childhood, who knows. And then if I move into the second form, that's where the familiar methods of relaxing the body and releasing tension out of the body come in, or that's where letting the feelings flow come in. Maybe expressing some feelings to another person, or maybe just feeling them flow inside yourself and kind of encouraging them to keep on flowing. This is where also, if you're aware of thoughts that are not wise, so that maybe they're left over from childhood or they're over the top or catastrophizing. So maybe I have a thought arise in my mind, something like, oh my God, this is terrible that she said that or did that. And then I can step back from that thought and realize, oh man, this is a small detail. She's stressed too. Don't worry so much about it. Mm-hmm. Okay. These are different practices we might do in the under the heading of the second way to practice, the releasing or reduction of what's negative. Also, I think sometimes what happens is we bring insight to bear, including drawing on meditative insight, where we start to recognize the transience, the impermanence, the insubstantiality of the experience. And in that recognition, in the second way to practice, we release this afflictive, kind of neurotic, you know, thought bubble that's you know, sitting on top of us, for example. And then in this natural trajectory, which often occurs, we start with just being with what's there. Then we move into releasing what's problematic. That's the second step. And then there's a natural opening that we can replace what we've released. Maybe we've released feelings of inadequacy, feelings of anger, and then we replace them, let's suppose, in the third way to relate to the mind, with feelings of self-worth or feelings of inner peace. And there's kind of a natural trajectory. And then sometimes what happens is that as we grow resources inside ourselves, we become more able to actually be with our feelings, to tolerate our distress. And to finish, mindfulness should be present in all three forms of relating to the mind. Another mistake that's crept into a lot of approaches in the West toward meditation and mindfulness, it has been to reduce mindfulness to only being used for bare witnessing. No, as the Buddha taught and others, we should be mindful while we're driving a car or having a tricky conversation with our brother-in-law or dealing with a child. We should be mindful under all conditions, whether including letting go or releasing what's problematic and receiving or growing what's good.
And so when you talk about the strategy for building like the inner strengths that you mentioned, like positive mood, common sense, integrity, inner peace, determination, and a warm heart, is that process, this process of turning these thoughts into experiences? And maybe now, can you go a little deeper into that sort of experience?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it really helps to make it super concrete. So a person, including a person listening, might think, wow, what am I trying to grow inside myself these days? Not out of clinging. Actually, as we cultivate, as we fill ourselves up from the inside out, the underlying causes of craving, the second noble truth in Buddhism, actually reduce because craving, drivenness, attachment, grasping, or aversion, or clinging are driven by an underlying sense of something missing, something wrong. So if through repeated moments that are authentic, usually brief moments in the flow of every day, that we take in the good into ourselves, then we gradually fill ourselves up and we feel full and balanced rather than something missing, something wrong, which helps us reduce the tendencies toward, you know, the craving, very broadly defined, that creates so much suffering and harm. So it's helpful to think about, gee, am I trying to become happier these days? Am I trying to become calmer or stronger or more emotionally balanced? Am I trying to grow perhaps a spiritual factor? Am I trying to develop greater steadiness of mind for my meditative practice? Whatever it is you're trying to grow. So then a person could, in the flow of their day, look for opportunities to experience that, whatever they're trying to grow. More gratitude, more love, more calm, more sense of worth, or related factors. And then when you see facts that support that experience, let's say another person is actually caring and loving toward you, or let's say you actually accomplished something meaningful from a load of laundry to a tricky email, then first notice the good fact, and then second, help the recognition of that fact be more than conceptual. Help it become an actual experience. So often, first, we don't notice the good facts around us. And second, we don't feel anything when we do notice them. So first, notice good facts. Second, let yourself have good experiences as a result, usually mild, but authentic. And then third, do what I suggested. And I developed these methods in great detail and their applications and so forth. But the essence is simple. Stay with the experience for a breath or two or three. Really try to feel it in your body and track what's rewarding about it. And that will really help it sink in. So that's kind of the fundamental process. And what I should just add about all that is if you look out at so many people in the world today, their actual material conditions are pretty good. Nothing in what I'm saying is about not trying to make the world a better place, deal with real issues out there in the world. But the truth is, again, just because even when conditions are pretty good, a lot of people feel empty and hungry inside. And that's because they're not actually internalizing their beneficial experiences. It's like super fast food that just kind of flows in and flows out, but doesn't leave any residues behind. And then that creates a consumer-based culture. One of the things that I see more broadly is that if we help ourselves more generally to actually internalize beneficial experiences, it will make us stronger and also will help us become less driven by craving and less caught up in conflicts with other people.
Yeah. I mean, it's so true what you're saying. You know, so many people do feel empty and they also feel negative. It's like, I mean, you also talk about in the book that negative thinking is like Velcro. Mm. And I like what you're saying about almost like attaching a practice to the cultivation of what's good. But I do wonder if everyone has the capacity for this, or if there's some people that are just in such dark and negative places. I mean, we've all met people like that. And I'm wondering if it's a desire to change that has to take place, or does everyone have the capacity for this type of shift in behavior and attitude?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's a famous famous joke among therapists. How many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one. But the light bulb has to want to change.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So at a fundamental level, what is interesting is when you start trying to help yourself, or frankly, or you start trying to help other people as a coach or a therapist or a parent, an educator or a manager or a teacher, including of mindfulness, when you start trying to help other people cultivate what's beneficial inside themselves, you start running into some very interesting blocks. And one of the benefits actually of this approach is that it surfaces those blocks. So let's suppose that a person actually is the light bulb that wants to change, that they really do want to start where they are, always authentically, and develop more of whatever is wise and helpful. They want to develop more skills with dealing with other people. That's a form of learning as well. That's a form of cultivation too, to become more skillful with your partner, your children, your coworkers, and so forth. Or let's suppose a person says, you know, I'm just way too rattled by stuff, and I want to develop more of an unshakable core inside myself of equanimity or inner strength and inner peace and happiness. I want to grow that. All right. So if a person has that intention, fundamentally, every brain has the capacity to learn. Every single brain has that capacity to learn. And crux issue is, does the person want to do it? Even really old people might get asked this question, people in their 90s. Oh, the brain has this fundamental capacity that's called neuroplasticity. The bottom line for me, just to finish, I guess, what motivates me about this is a very old school take that first, life is often hard and we need to have resources inside to deal with it. And second, we've got a brain, as you alluded to a moment ago, that is designed by Mother Nature to be like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones, because that's what kept our ancestors alive in really harsh conditions. Today, in a war zone, a real war zone, the negativity bias, the scientists put it, of the brain is a useful thing. But for most people, the evolved negativity bias of the brain, like Velcro for the bad, Teflon for the good, is not a good thing. It creates a lot of needless suffering and a lot of needless conflict with it.
Yeah.
So in a very hard-headed, old-school kind of way, for me, when there's a recognition here that first, we have to grow resources inside ourselves, and second, if we tilt toward beneficial, useful, usually enjoyable experiences, we're simply leveling the playing field that Mother Nature has handed to us.
Yeah. Can you change someone else? And I'm sure that people that are listening and ourselves, we know either parents or friends, people that are just constantly seeing the glass half empty. And is there a way to ease someone into a shift in attitude?
That's a great question. I think first and foremost, we need to start with that first way to practice, which is to be with the pain of the other person and to really listen and give the gift of a deep listening, and including without playing therapist with people who haven't invited us into that role, a kind of uncovering and a receptivity. And as a quick sidebar, to be able to be really wide open with empathy and compassion to another person, we have to grow the resource inside ourselves of autonomy and equanimity. Otherwise, we get blown away by that other person. In the saying, proverb, fences make for good neighbors. So by growing those inner strengths of autonomy and equanimity inside ourselves, then we can become truly more receptive and loving to other people. So then I have found that actually when people understand a little bit that if they want to become, let's say, happier, or they want to become more resourced so that they can cope with what's bothering them or afflicting them or the real tough conditions in the real world that they're dealing with, when people hear that, oh, wow, we're talking about changing your brain for the better. And the way the brain changes for the better is in this fundamental two-stage process. First, you have to experience what you want to grow. Second, you've got to internalize it. You've got to slow it down and help it sink into the nervous system itself. That brainizing, apologizing of the bottom line here is really persuasive to many, many people. It's scientifically grounded. It's true. It's grounded in the body. It's kind of mechanical. So people get, oh yeah, that's really how it works. And then if people start trying to do it, if they're willing, if they're their light bulb who wants to change, and if they're willing to take half a dozen times in a day, less than half a minute at a time, to recognize a good fact, help it become a good experience, and then third, take that experience into themselves, I have truly found again and again, and I've had many people report to me, that when others are willing to do that simple practice they feel different and better at the end of the first day they try.
And it's not, and you don't even have to meditate. This isn't a meditation that you're recommending. This is like, a moment.
Yeah. Technically, in a meditative language, it's like a micro concentration practice. It's a micro absorption practice where for 5, 10, 20, 30 or more seconds in a row, you take as your object of meditation, in a sense, this beneficial experience that you're sinking into, and you're helping it sink into you as you sink into it. Yeah, that's exactly, but that's about it. It's you can apply it as well during meditation or during other practices like yoga or Pilates or walking the dog or hanging out with your granddaughter, that you could use it in those settings too. And certainly during formal meditative practice, you can use these methods to really help the fruits of your practice sink into you and transform you from the inside out.
Oh, I love what you're saying about letting it just sink in. Because I think, you know, part of our very, very busy culture, and we talk about autopilot a lot on this podcast, it just seems to come up. And this idea of just sort of stopping and letting what's good sink in, I think will resonate with a lot of people. It certainly does with me. You mentioned also that, I think you use this language, the magic cure is continuing to learn in order to continually grow. Yeah. And can you talk a bit about that? And I'm guessing that has something also to do with neuroplasticity, but I'd love to hear what you think of that.
From a really practical perspective, if you think about it, okay, we're interested in healing, we're interested in development, in growth, whether it's in our work, our family, or personal relationships, or our inner world. We want to heal. We want to develop. We want to progress down the path of, if it's of interest, of self-actualization or awakening. All right. Well, guess what? That's about learning in the broadest sense. Healing, development, growth, transformation, awakening. It's all about learning fundamentally. So if you think about it, what we want to develop inside ourselves is one thing or another, like greater happiness or greater calm or greater insight or greater love. We want to grow that inside ourselves. That those things we're trying to grow inside ourselves are like superpowers, because I read a lot of comics when I was a kid. But then the question is, but the how of learning that you and I are talking about here, this two-stage process, first you experience it, and then second, you got to internalize it in the body. That is the superpower of superpowers. This is the superpower we draw upon to grow the rest of them. And I think a lot about just a very simple idea, which is at the end of any given day, when you go to bed, are you a little happier, a little wiser, a little more peaceful, a little more loving than you were, a little more resilient than you were when you first woke up? That's your learning curve over the course of the day, your growth curve. And that little increment, where you are at the end of the day compared to where you are when you first woke up, that little bit of beneficial change accumulated across the days and months and years of your life makes all the difference in the world.
What is actually happening in your brain when you're doing this?
That's very interesting. You're actually changing it. So just to list a number of mechanisms, there's a classic saying that kind of summarizes a lot of this. Neurons that fire together, wire together. So literally, new connections form between neurons in your brain, connections called synapses. So fundamentally, the learning process inside your brain, new connections are forming. Existing connections get sensitized. More blood starts moving to parts of your brain that do important things, literally thickening layers of cortex in your brain. For example, meditators, long-term meditators, have measurably thicker cortex in key regions of the brain that are involved with steadiness of mind, as well as really tuning into yourself in a very, very deep way. Also, there are changes in the expression of genes, epigenetic processes, they're called, inside the cell bodies of neurons, changes in brain waves, changes in ebbs and flows of key neurotransmitters like oxytocin and serotonin and dopamine and natural opioids. The brain is designed to be changed by our experiences. Problem is, it's vulnerable to being changed for the worse due to the negativity bias. And so for me, the takeaway point is to be skillful multiple times a day to help the brain change for the better from the inside out.
Yeah, it's funny because I was just thinking that if there were one takeaway from all the richness of what you're sharing here, it's that developing this habit of taking in the good as you go about your day and really learning to be skillful about that. Do you think that there's a role for gratitude in this practice as well? Or is that part of taking in the good is recognizing joy, recognizing gratitude, being able to forgive?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that gratitude is one of the inner strengths, one of the inner resources we want to grow, that stance of thankfulness. Because I've written and taught about this for a long time, I have found that it's easy for people to sort of it's easier for people to unwittingly trivialize and reduce this to something like, oh yeah, I need to smell the roses. Well, that's really good. But I'm talking about something much more profound and far reaching than that.
Right.
So for example, to deal with real issues of life, we need to acquire resilience. Resilience is not just about surviving the worst day of your life. It's about thriving every day of your life. So that sense of determination and emotional balance and grit is a really important thing to grow. And that's not about gratitude. And another thing to grow inside ourselves, honestly, is healthy remorse, to really let it land when we've acted harshly with another person or unskillfully, or we've indulged our desires in ways that are problematic. And it's important to kind of register, oh, whoa, I messed up here and I need to learn that lesson. That's not about gratitude either, for example. Or subtle insights, the insight into the impermanence of experience, or what what stillness feels like underneath it all. That too is something to internalize and take into ourselves. There's a traditional saying, the mind takes its shape from what it repeatedly rests upon, for better or worse.
Yeah.
And the modern update would be your brain takes its shape from what your mind repeatedly rests upon, for better or worse. For me, it boils down to something very simple. What shape do you want to take?
Yeah.
Who do you want to be? Who do you want to become? Not out of chasing pleasure in some, silly hedonistic sense, but in including the magnificence of the spiritual process. Who do you want to become? Who do you want to be? Including what you want to become is what you've always been, but which was obscured. But even that is a fundamental kind of change.
Yeah.
And then knowing who you want to be, what you want to help yourself grow into being a little bit more every day, then you rest your mind upon that. And that is really wide open. And it goes much more broadly than smelling the roses.
Yeah, absolutely. Is your mind the witnessing part versus your brain? I know a lot of people are curious about what the difference is between the mind and the brain.
Yeah, exactly. It's a key question, right? It depends how people use the word. In the scientific community, mind equals information. It's crazy, right? But it does. So if the nervous system, it's evolved to represent information and to, for example, enable the motor systems of our ancient ancestors to communicate information with their sensory systems. Smells good, swim forward. Smells bad, swim backward, right? And so that's communication. And so that's what the nervous system does. And words like mental or cognition or thought have to do with flows of information. The ways that the material processes of the nervous system and the immaterial but still natural processes of information flows in the nervous system, the ways in which that becomes an experience, that is still a great mystery. Whether it's the experience of humans or squirrels, cats, mice, lizards, who knows? The ways in which phenomenology or experience manifest, that's still a scientific mystery. I've taken by traditional Tibetan sayings. One of them is moments of awakening many times a day. And the other saying relates to it, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. Sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening. And that process of cultivation is what we've mainly talked about here. And I think of it as no one can stop you from cultivating a little bit more happiness, love, and wisdom every day. No one can stop you from doing that inside the sanctuary of your own mind.
Yeah.
And, that's a beautiful thing, but it also takes us to that responsibility. It's on us.
It's on us.
Engage that process of cultivation and awakening every day.
Well, I am so grateful for you giving us all of these great insights and tools and steps. Thank you so much for being here today, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much to Rick for being with us today. You can get his book, Hardwiring Happiness, at all major booksellers. His website is at rickhansen.net. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store. We'll see you next time.